The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Lisa Maxwell from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading from Reminisce Magazine. Keeping up appearances. After the war, he started a new life in a different country. By Ann Plodson of Lucas, Ohio. The Hand side of my family came from England to the Midwest in the 1920s. Grandmother Mary Ann, called Polly, was the oldest of seven children. I loved to look at her photos and asked many questions, and later enjoyed researching the family. I went to England to meet relatives who still lived in the same area. Gran told my cousin Jane and me our family was next to royalty. Aunt Elsie, Gran's sister, lived to be 105, and she also told us many stories, including about her brother, Jack. Great-uncle Jack was in the British infantry and fought in the trenches during World War I. After the war, he went to Australia, then joined his parents and brother Sam in America. He married twice. His first wife died and never had children. Gran remained silent about family scandal that was revealed in May of 2018 when Chris Hand of Huddersfield, England, contacted Jane. His grandfather, John, was the son of Jack, who'd married an Englishwoman named Nellie before the war. Chris told us Jack abandoned his young family, which was traumatic for his little boy, John. Chris also found letters from Mary Ann to Nellie. This was a shock, as no one ever talked about Jack's first family, even though they must have known about it. Gran told the Hand history the way she wanted it to be. As Chris and I have gotten better acquainted, it is uncanny how similar our life views are. Is this nurture or nature? We share whatever family tidbits we learn. My international travel days are at an end, but I hope to meet him one day. And there's a little side article that accompanies this article I just read for you, and it's titled Nature and Nurture. Just when we think we've researched our family pretty well, something new comes along to make us look more thoroughly. Anne's newfound English cousin brought up a lot of mysteries, which shows two things. One, our research is never quite complete. And two, we must be open to learning about what others discover for the family we think we know. Jack may have experienced shell shock, now known as post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Without social services to help deal with the stress and horror of war, it appears Jack did what many soldiers have done through military history. He didn't go home, and he didn't talk about it. He simply started over. Uncovering the reasons he chose to neglect his wife and the only child he would have and leave them wandering in England would be difficult. We do know Grandmother felt family appearance was important. Nature and nurture are certainly part of our makeup, as we discover when meeting new relatives. Our next article is titled, She Liked Ike and Mamie Too. Her Portraits of the President and First Lady Get a Surprising and Cherished Response, by Diane Henriksen Russell of Brandon, Florida. Back in 1956, my parents watched politics on TV often. Even though there were just three commercial stations and a public television station in the Chicago area, they managed to cover President Dwight D. Eisenhower well. Not only was he our president, he was running for re-election that fall. It was perfectly normal to see my father, Art Henriksen, sketching caricatures of Ike and other politicians while watching television. After all, he made a living drawing gag and editorial cartoons for local newspapers. In June 1956, my dad even created an animated character for WNBQ-TV to introduce color television to Chicagoland. Red-haired Tommy Tent was dressed in a green shirt and blue overalls. Tommy painted the town and blew it up with a dynamite plunger to show off the vivid primary colors and entice the audience to tune in. Unfortunately, our family did not own a color TV set, so we missed seeing Tommy in WNBQ in living color. As an enthusiastic preschooler, I positioned my own small desk and chair in front of our black and white television set during the evening news. I loved Ike. My parents wore "I Like Ike" campaign buttons, and my grandmother even wore a rhinestone Ike pin to promote his reelection. Soon I started imitating my dad and drew and colored my own caricatures of Ike. I eventually added First Lady Mamie to my repertoire. I especially loved her bangs and red hat. My dad was not shy about his pride in my drawings of Ike and Mamie. He also was a loyal Republican. Ironically, the Democratic presidential candidate that election was Adlai Stevenson, who was from our home state of Illinois. One day, my dad suggested that I mail my drawings of Ike and Mamie to the president and first lady. I carefully drew and colored special drawings for each of them. My mom, Lois, addressed the envelope to the White House, placed my drawings inside, and drove them to the nearest post office. I continued doing the normal things a four-year-old does, attending preschool and Sunday school, playing with my neighborhood friends, and singing along with the albums of my favorite musicals. 2 weeks after the November election, my parents brought in the mail and exclaimed, "You have a letter from the White House, Diane." They carefully opened the envelope. Inside on White House stationery was a letter signed by the First Lady. My mom read it aloud. "Dear Diane, I do want to thank you ever so much for the wonderful pictures you drew of the President and me. Our hearts were truly touched when we received them, and I assure you we are both more than delighted to have them as a special token of your sincere friendship. With gratitude and very best wishes to you and your family, Mamie Dowd Eisenhower." I was thrilled beyond words. I screamed with excitement as my four-year-old would. I told all of my friends while my parents called and wrote our relatives. My parents took it one step further. They contacted several Chicago and Des Plaines local newspapers. Shortly afterward, reporters and a photographer came to our house to interview us and take a photo of my mother and me with the letter. The newspaper articles were published in late November 1956. I became an even bigger fan of Ike and Mamie, of course. My parents mailed my Valentine to them in early 1958. I was surprised to receive a second letter from the White House. It was written on White House letterhead and signed by the First Lady's secretary. My treasured 1956 letter from First Lady Mamie Eisenhower hangs on my wall to this day, and I still like Ike and Mamie. And from Motoring Memories, our next article is titled, "Classic is Better Every Year. Lincoln Convertible Takes Couple Through Milestones," by Nadine Rogg of Goshen, Connecticut. My brother came home one day in 1952 with his friend Herm riding on the back of his motorcycle. Herm looked like a nice guy, and he called me the following day for a date. Herm didn't really have much money for dating. He was in his 20s like me, and he worked 6 days a week while also attending college 4 nights a week. But he showed up for the date driving a beautiful shiny black 1940 Lincoln Continental with the top down. In his hand was a yellow rose. Wow, I was so impressed. We drove to High Point Park in New Jersey, where he took a photo of me sitting on the fender of the car. The Lincoln continued to be an important part of our lives. The year after we met, Herm and I went for another ride to another park, where he proposed with a gorgeous diamond engagement ring. We were married the next year and drove the car on our honeymoon to New York's Lake George and Niagara Falls. Our family grew, and with our two children, we toured many states with the Classic Car Club of America. Our children love the memories of those family trips. On our 25th and 50th anniversaries, Herm and I celebrated by touring New England in the Lincoln. For our 60th anniversary, we had a big celebration at the local country club. The Lincoln was decorated with white balloons, and Herm parked it in front of the club. our local newspaper featured us as Sweethearts of the Week. After many wonderful years of marriage, we are in pretty good health, and so is the Lincoln, well housed in our garage. Over 6 decades, the car has been wonderful, but Herm has been even better. Showing a flair for nature, she learns high fashion is best left to the city. One perfect day in 1972, when I was 10, I was visiting my grandparents with a handful of relatives. We were strolling around the spacious front yard of their farm. I was very proud of my new high-fashion red jeans. These were not just regular bell-bottoms, which were all the rage at the time, but super bell-bottoms, what we dubbed elephant pants. The flare was about a foot wide. I had to put rubber bands around the ankles when I rode my bike to keep the jeans from getting stuck in the chain. As we continued our peaceful walk, I felt a strange sensation on one leg. With horror, I realized an insect was inside one leg of my flared pants, jumping around. "Help! Help!" I screamed. My dad, fearing I was catastrophically injured, raced to my side. "What's wrong?" "A cricket jumped up on my pants leg." "Get it out! Get it out!" I jerked my leg higher and higher, kicking like a rocket. Soon the walkers gathered around. I rolled up the pants leg, looking for the offending critter. It was no use. The cricket jumped farther up my pants leg. Then, horror upon horror, my practical dad said, "Pull down your pants so we can shake it out." "No," I screeched, but was removing my pants in front of assorted relatives, worse than having a cricket traverse my leg. What must be done must be done. The adults instructed the snickering cousins to turn around and resume walking as I dropped my pants. As soon as the pants came down, the hideous cricket was spotted right on what my farm relatives called my hinder. As the cricket jumped to freedom, it seemed just as happy to escape as I was to see it leave. And from our heroes section, the shock of war. Soldier came home from France, but battled after effects of World War I by Kay Ladwig of Green Lake, Wisconsin. Uncle Pete, my dad's older brother, arrived at our farm near Tomahawk, Wisconsin, nearly every summer for haying. At the end of the season, he'd leave for parts unknown, telling me and my sister Patsy, "It's time to hit the road." Mom explained that Pete served in World War I, and when he came home from the war, he'd been changed by the bad things he'd seen. She called it shell shock. At the end of one season, Mom paid Pete and gave him a new shirt, pants, and a denim jacket from Montgomery Ward. He looked pretty snazzy when he left. A week later, we saw him sitting on a street corner in ratty old clothes. Mom had a look on her face as she drove to O.K. Welty's Tavern, where she left us in the car. Soon she came out with Pete's new clothes. Later I learned that Pete had traded his new outfit for his favorite drink, wine. When I was 10, I begged my mother all summer for a friendship ring like my friend got for her birthday. It had two tiny hands that opened separately and clasped together perfectly with a small screw. When he left that season, Pete gave Patsy and me each our very own friendship rings. I got my first job in our small local hospital at age 15. It was run by an order of nuns, and in the lower-level kitchen was a window well where Sister Sarah put out food for the hungry. Early one morning, I opened the window, and there was Pete. "Katie," as he called me, "is that you?" I turned away, embarrassed, pretending I didn't know my dear uncle. Several years passed, and as Pete's drinking got worse, I lost touch with him. One night in the 70s, I joined my friend Con to honor her first year of sobriety at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. As we walked down the steps of the old brick church, a familiar voice shouted, "Katie, honey, what are you doing here? Don't tell me you're a drunk like me." I rushed to hug Uncle Pete. Years later, I contacted Pete for a family history, and he graciously responded with a 10-page letter that included the proud moment when he discovered AA. My uncle was, in his own words, a far from perfect man, but I'm proud to honor him. And from the True Love section, Rainy Day at the Lake, It Would Have Been a Good Day to See a Movie, by Earl Cornell of Palmdale, California. My job as a store clerk when I was in high school in Parsons, Kansas, left me with little time to meet young ladies. One evening in 1952, my friend Ron Grandin and I met after work to go to the auditorium where students were preparing for the graduation ceremony. There I met junior Carolyn Bruner, whom I invited to a movie a couple of days later. Summer was coming, and as we continued to date, I wanted to take her somewhere besides movies. There were stock car races, but neither of us liked the noise and dust, so one June morning, my mother made a picnic lunch to take to Grand Lake, Oklahoma. I picked up Carolyn and her friends Nancy and Jean. Carolyn was lovely in black jeans and a light green blouse. At the lake, I rented a boat, and we loaded up everything and shoved off for an adventure. We were not out very long when the motor quit. As I futilely tried to restart it, white clouds bunched up and it started to rain. We had to be towed back to the dock by a Grand River Dam Authority cruiser. The rain was coming down harder, so we grabbed our lunch and raced to the car. I drove around the lake looking for a shelter house, but instead we found ourselves on open range land. It was still raining, so surrounded by curious cattle looking in the windows, we ate fried chicken and potato salad on paper plates. To go with Mom's cherry pie, I had packed a modern convenience, Ready Whip in a can. I shook the can briskly, aimed at the plate, and sent whipped cream flying everywhere except on the pie. Carolyn remained calm and cleaned up her black jeans as best she could. She also took over dispensing Ready Whip. The rain was still coming down as I dropped everyone off. After the disastrous date, I called Carolyn to see if she wanted to go to a movie. Luckily, she agreed. We continued to date as often as work and school would allow. In March 1953, I enlisted in the Air Force and was sent to California, then Texas. Our romance continued by mail, and occasionally I came home for a visit. We got married in November that year, and after a short honeymoon, I was on my way to North Africa. Eventually, we ended up in California, where we remain. Trip marks end of an era. Small Town Senior comes home with a new perspective, by Sharon Fields of Bedford, Indiana. Each Midland school class chose where to go for its senior trip. Students earn money with car washes, bake sales, and other schemes. My mother helped me earn money by working on a farm dressing turkeys. 17 small town and country kids left Greene County, Indiana, some for the first time, in May 1963 to experience the world without parents. Mrs. Agnes Smith and Miss Bernice Mitchell, two brave teachers with hearts of gold and nerves of steel, accompanied us. The ladies drove their own Chevys, each car filled to the brim with students, to catch the Illinois Central from Evanston to Louisiana. Crossing the Salt Marches and Lake Pontchartrain as we reached Kenner was a thrill. It was the first time any of us had stayed in a hotel. Mimosa trees surrounded the Holiday Inn's clover-leaf-shaped pool, and its narrow stem led inside to the bar, which we stayed away from but observed curiously. Pauline, Beverly, and I roomed together, and in the evening, Miss Mitchell and Mrs. Smith came to our room to warn us not to venture from the group because of the danger of being snatched and taken captive in underground trade. With only two of them in charge of 17 kids, our chaperones might have resorted to a little fear insurance to keep us all from doing something stupid. We toured New Orleans French Quarter and posed near the cathedral on Jackson Square. Country kids dressed in our finest suits and dresses, we were quite a spiffy bunch. I also fondly recall going for late evening espresso and donuts. Next, we traveled to Biloxi, Mississippi. From our motel there, we crossed a bridge over the highway to the Gulf of Mexico. I sat on the beach with my best friends. It was the first time I'd ever been to the ocean. In the evening, we went to a nightclub for dinner and a show by teen idol Mark Dining. He pointed out our class in the audience as he sang. What a night. The air conditioning on the train home went out, so it was warm and muggy, adding to the misery of the long trip. But as we waited in the school parking lot for our parents, I felt a deep sadness. The people I'd spent my life with were about to part ways just when we'd grown up. I look back on the trip with a mixture of joy and a lump in my throat, picturing us as we bade farewell to childhood days and moved on to new things. Graduation day in the gymnasium was hot. My hands shook as we stood together as a class one last time on the stage in the old high school. Values and dresses are made to hand down. Sewing 5 Easter frocks is a project in patience by Ann Porter of Old Fort, Tennessee. One by one, our mother, Mary Alice, called us 5 little girls to be measured. We had to hold our arms straight out from our sides as she slipped the tape around our chest and across our shoulders. She was making Easter dresses, and she had less than a week to finish. She jotted down our measurements, then set the project aside to give us our baths and make supper. We gathered around for a Bible story, knelt to send childish petitions heavenward, and at last wriggled into the just a little bigger than twin-sized bed all 5 of us, ages 2 to 8, shared. Our lullaby that night was the steady crunch, crunch, crunch of Mother's steel scissors against the tabletop. She drew the simple design and cut patterns from the Cleveland Daily Banner. Each seersucker dress was a different spring color, and starting with the smallest, each dress was a little larger than the one before. For her, there would be a maternity smock. The first of our 2 baby brothers was due to arrive in August. A good tailor knows the importance of the thread, and Mother took a spool from the row of Coates and Clark colors in her sewing box, unwound the sturdy strand, and gave it a tug. It needed to be strong enough to hold through summers to come as the dresses were handed down from Jenna to Becky to me to Jackie and at last to Patty. The next morning, our breakfast was quickly cleared to make room for the heirloom singer, and sing it did, giving a concert for days until finally, on Saturday evening, the last dress was sewn and Mother worked late into the night finishing the hymns by hand. At church the next morning, we lined up beside her on the pew in the soft puffs of colors. This was a special day and the perfect occasion to wear dresses that were clean and new. We heard the remarkable Easter story of a love great enough to forgive us and to enable us to forgive and love each other. It was the same story that Mother patiently taught us every day. And from the front and center section, we have a profile on actor James Garner. In 1957, James Garner was newly married and about 3 years into his career as an actor, which he settled on after a string of dead-end jobs. Not yet 30, he already had a reputation for playing wry, witty anti-heroes, helped along by what had to have been the most charming grin in Hollywood. There was no one better to play a lovable rogue and gambler who'd rather con his way out of a fight than put up his dukes in the surprise TV hit of 57, the comic anti-Western Maverick. And here are some interesting facts about James Garner. He had 2 Purple Hearts. Garner was the first Oklahoman drafted into the Army to serve in Korea in 1950. He was hurt twice, in the hand and face from mortar round shrapnel and in the buttocks from friendly fire. He was his unit's scrounger, finding needful items by any means. He drew on that wartime experience when cast of one of his most memorable film roles, Henley the Scrounger in The Great Escape, made in 1963. He and Lois Clark dated for 14 days, then they married. Their union lasted 57 years. Clark knew how hard it was for her husband to exude the easygoing air that made him famous. Jim is a rather complicated man and is covering up lots of hurt, she once observed. He had a long, mostly good-natured feud with Steve McQueen. McQueen wrongly believed that Garner had had an affair with his first wife, so he took delight in harassing Garner for years. Yet when filmmakers dropped the unruly McQueen from The Great Escape and offered the starring role to Garner, it was Garner who brokered a peace and persuaded McQueen to stay on as the lead. He drove the pace car at the Indy 500 three times, in 1975, 78, and 85. Like his friend Paul Newman, Garner enjoyed racing and had his own team. He had one Oscar nomination in his 50-year career, for his role as an amiable pharmacist in Murphy's Romance, made in 1985. And from our time capsule of 1957, amniocentesis. Testing amniotic fluid increases in the 1950s, mainly to look for blood incompatibility between the fetus and the mother. Clip art. With desktop publishing decades away, designers literally clip out printed images for reuse in publications. Disco. In the 50s, it's short for discotheque, meaning a nightclub for dancing. In the 70s, the definition embraces a style of music and dance. Doggy bag. The take-home container emerged during World War II when pet owners were encouraged to feed table scraps to their pets instead of wasting food. Fanny pack. A Sports Illustrated ad in the mid-50s touts a leather pouch skiers or other outdoor athletes wear around the waist to hold necessities. Go-kart. Editors at Rod and Custom magazine coined this word to mean the small motorized vehicles enthusiasts raced at the 1957 Rose Bowl. Gold record. The music industry award for at least 500,000 units sold. In 1957, Harry Belafonte wins it for his million-selling Calypso. Leaf blower. When they notice that their portable crop dusters are also moving debris across the lawn, homeowners quit filling the tanks with pesticide and just use the devices to clear the yard. We've run out of time for today's episode of Reminisce. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.